Over the past 2 months, we've walked through James, identifying many of the practical commands that we find within it. And today, I want to end with just one more. Be patient. Be patient. This is going to be fun. You can go ahead and turn in your Bibles to James chapter 5. And as you are turning there, I just want you to think about something with me. Just think about this. We are, without a doubt, the most impatient culture in all of history. Like, it's not even close. We are the most impatient culture in all of history. There's a reason that my generation and the generations that come after me are called the instant gratification generations. We have everything at our fingertips at a moment's notice. And I mean everything. And if there is something that we can't get fast enough, you can guarantee there's somebody out there thinking of a way right now how they can speed it up. I mean, literally, look at the way in which our world has changed even over the last 10 to 20 years. Let's start with communication. When was the last time you had to handwrite a letter and put it in the mail, maybe the Pony Express, to get to somebody some information? Well, of course not. We have a handy-dandy thing called a smartphone. I can text you, I can email you, I can Facebook message you, I can Skype you, I can FaceTime you, I can WhatsApp you. We have literally thousands of ways to get in touch with people like that. And if for whatever reason I send you a message and you don't get back to me within the 30 seconds that I need you to get back to me right now, then I have a right to be upset with you and your inability to get back to me instantly. It's my God-given right. But communication is just the beginning. Let's look at food for a second. How many of you have seen the Jimmy John commercials? You might have missed it because if you blink for 1 second, they're already done. But Jimmy John's the commercial where freaky fast delivery, right? The store where you can be on the phone ordering, and before you're even off the phone, there's a guy handing you your food you just ordered. Or what about my favorite, fast food? You don't even have to go inside the building anymore because we have something called a drive-thru that's faster and easier. You can just pull up alongside, order your food, and get it just like that. And you know what? I don't know if you've noticed, but McDonald's even has 2 lanes in their fast food because 1 lane just isn't fast enough. We need that fast food right now. The best part is that in order to keep up with all the fast food we eat, we obviously need to work out, go on a diet, which is why we have books like the 21-Day Weight Loss Challenge, How to Lose 10 Pounds in a Week, and the Fast Metabolism Diet. Because if you can't lose weight fast, then it's not worth losing at all, correct? And these are just a few of the books that I noticed at a brief glance on Amazon. Which, speaking of Amazon, if you have Amazon Prime, that 2-day free shipping is kind of convenient, isn't it? And you know what? I actually just saw an advertisement the other day that there is no joke, fast and free is now even faster. Prime members in 27 major cities receive free same-day delivery on qualifying orders over $35. Order in the morning, and your package will be delivered by 9 p.m. 7 days a week. We literally have no reason to leave the house anymore whatsoever. And speaking of the internet, thanks to Netflix, we never have to wait for another movie again. In fact, we spend, well, really the only waiting we do is the time it takes to pick which movie we're going to watch. We spend more time looking for a movie than we do actually watching one. But even so, I read that there are 33 million Netflix subscribers only on their streaming plan to about 8 million on their DVD plan. Which just goes to show you, nobody wants to wait for the DVD to come in the mail anymore. If we can't get it on the streaming, we're not going to waste our time with it. We have to have it now. And what in the world did we do before Google? Good old Google. I mean, just think of all the random pieces of trivia that would have tortured us for days until we randomly woke up in the middle of the night to remember that a group of stingrays is called a fever. That's right, a fever. Thanks, Google. But you see, our culture has gotten even smarter about our need for instant gratification. And they've realized that it's so ingrained within us that we will even pay to get it faster. Just look at Disney World or Cedar Point. Don't want to wait in line for an hour at every single ride? That's okay. For twice the cost of a normal ticket, you can have a fast pass. You can skip all the lines and wave at all those suckers who are waiting for 2 hours and jump right on front. Never wait in line again. I could go on forever like this, but here's the point. We are literally doing everything we can possibly think of to eliminate any need or reason to be patient. And I love how Matt Chandler puts it. He says, there's this really ironic thing happening where the more we make the world faster and easier, the more perpetually impatient we actually are. The more we make the world faster and easier, the more perpetually impatient we actually are. And so we turn to James 5:7. James 5:7. And the very first words we read are what? Be patient. Uh-oh. Let's start back at verse 1 because I want us to have a better understanding of the context that we find ourselves in. So James chapter 5 verse 1, read with me. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Verse 7, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. And so here's the first thing that we need to understand. In verses 1 through 6, James is basically calling out the wealthy and the rich landowners who are taking advantage of the laborers by withholding their wages. He says they will weep and howl for the miseries that they have done. Their riches will rot and rust because of the wages that they have kept back for themselves. Their withholding of those wages, their storing up of their wealth in luxury and in self-indulgence. And James is basically saying, your wealth will rot and you will know nothing but misery. But then in verse 7, we read this. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. And so here in verse 7, what happens is James turns his attention from the rich and the wealthy who are taking advantage of the laborers, who are oppressing them, forcing them to work but not paying them, storing up their wealth and their luxuries. And he turns his attention to those who are being oppressed, to the community that he's writing to. He turns his attention to the poor. And he says, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. The theologian Craig Blomberg dives a little deeper into the word that James uses here. And he writes this. He says, the verb be patient contains two nuances. Like James' more common verb, endure, this term calls his listeners to wait and not become overly zealous, not turning to violence to further the cause of Christ in the face of oppression. But the word is not as passive as endure, for it also calls the believers under affliction to persevere and to not give up despite the persecution. But it's significant here that James says, be patient until the coming of the Lord. Because that phrase, the coming of the Lord, carries with it many eschatological ideas and inferences. And that word means end times. It carries with it a lot of ideas that relate to the end times, that relate to things like judgment and wrath and the coming of the Lord. It brings to mind the last days. In this case, the wealthy landowners who are oppressing this community of laborers that James is writing to. And so the idea that James presents here is one of being patient and persevering. And it's shaped eschatologically, or shaped with the end times in mind, in order that the community of poor would choose to wait for God's righteous judgment instead of taking matters into their own hands. James is saying, look, I understand. You're hurting. You're being oppressed. You're afflicted. But be patient. Don't take this into your own hands. Don't rise up. Don't be violent, because the Lord is coming. And when he comes, you will be vindicated. He is the judge. Let him judge. And so James finishes off verse 7 with an illustration. He writes this, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until he receives the early and the late rains. James' use of the farmer as an illustration is ideal, specifically because once a farmer plants his crops, there's absolutely nothing he can do to force his crops to grow any faster, or bigger, or more bountiful, or even at all. The farmer can only do as his crops allow. He can wait and be patient as time takes its course. But here's the thing. As Blomberg continues on, he says, farmers, however, hardly sat idle in between the sowing and the reaping. Rather, they worked hard in weeding, in hoeing, in fertilizing, and doing whatever they could to bring their crops to full fruition. You see, despite the fact that the farmer was at the complete mercy of the weather and of the climate and of the earth and of the soil, he didn't sit around and lazily just twiddle his thumbs. No, instead, he waited with a patience that expresses perseverance. And that perseverance is expressed through the nuance of the word James uses in this verse. It's both passive but not pacifist. Because just as the farmer can do nothing to force God's hand in the sending of rain or in the process of growth, we can relate. We cannot compel Christ to return any quicker. no matter how hard we try. Sure, we can pray for it, absolutely, and we should. And we should long for it. But his return is set in his mind. And yet that does not give us excuse to do nothing while we wait. You see, patience does not mean inaction. We too can right now work while we wait for the coming of the Lord to help prepare the land for his return. But we have to understand what that entails. Our work, our role is not one of judgment, wrath, and condemnation. That is the Lord's role to come. Ours is one of continued perseverance, evidencing the realities of life that James has presented all throughout this book. The things that you just heard, counting our trials as joy, believing and not doubting, being quick to listen and slow to speak, being doers of the word, taming the tongue and humbling ourselves before the Lord. That is evidence of our perseverance in patience. In these ways, we in fact evidence a patient perseverance in the face of those who would seek to oppress us. And in this way, we are like the farmer. However, as we further flesh out the difficulties in such a patient approach, we see that the waiting is often hard, isn't it? Difficulties within the community must be dealt with. And the correct understanding and practice of the faith and works dynamic must be taught and maintained. It is easily misunderstood, as the letter of James itself demonstrates. Certainly, James is calling on Christians to allow God to judge the wicked. To arrogate to ourselves this task is to call down God's judgment on ourselves. And this is where we can't forget who James is now addressing in these verses. His audience here is so important. Because let's be honest, it's easy to be patient when life is going our way. When there's very little that we have to worry about. When things are hunky-dory, fine and dandy, peachy keen, it's easy to be patient. It's a lot harder when we're overwhelmed, when we're oppressed on every side, when we feel like we're being boxed in and there's no escape, when the hurts are so real, when the pain is so deep, and there is no escape, then there is nothing harder than patience. Then we cry out, God, where are you? I need you. That is when we have to wait on God. But that was not the situation of the people James is addressing, as far as easy. Their life was hard. They were oppressed. And so patience for them was difficult. These are the poor, the ones who have had their wages stolen, and who desire vengeance and justice for their oppressors. And so in verse 8, James closes out that idea by saying again, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. And James had a very real understanding that this coming of the Lord was imminent. It was at hand. And so his point is, look, the Lord is coming. And when he does, vengeance will be his. Justice will be his. Wrath will be poured out upon your enemies. And you will be rewarded for your patience. And so over and over again, I just see James' audience saying to him, James, do you see the trials that we're going through? Do you see the tribulations that we have experienced? Do you see the hardships that we have lived with? Because we are about to fight back. We are about to rise up against this. Because no one seems to be doing it for us. And our cries have not been heard. Our answers are nowhere. And James is just saying, my friends, my brothers, I know your hurts. I know your pain. And even more so, God knows it. He sees you. And to be seen is to be loved. Just be patient. It is coming, I promise. It is close, it is nearer than you know. Just hold on a little bit longer. Be patient. But then James does an important thing. He turns his attention inward to the community of believers themselves. So far, his attention has been focused squarely on the outside forces that are oppressing this community. But here in verse 9, we read, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." And I love this verse because I think this is what James is doing. I think this is what he is addressing here. Something that we all have experienced and known intimately. How many of you have been so frustrated or maybe overwhelmed that you start to get a bit prickly? You start to get a bit antagonistic. And the people that come in contact with you all of a sudden realize, whoa, I need to watch out for that person. And it's not even their fault. But the things that are going on in your life that they may not know about have you on edge. And sometimes you can be rude and we can lash out. And we can hurt people unintentionally from what we say. People that had nothing to do with what we're going through. People that have no idea what we've experienced. And yet we lash out because we are hurting. We are overwhelmed. Now, I know none of you have felt like that before. Obviously, it's your spouse or your boss or your kids. But I know that we can all understand what I mean. Because this is what I think James is talking about here. He's saying, look, I know you guys are feeling overwhelmed, oppressed. And you just want to rise up against your oppressors. And here I am telling you to calm down and just be patient. And I get that you don't even probably like to hear that. But you need to watch yourselves because I'm starting to hear some grumbling, not just directed towards your oppressors, but directed towards each other. You are not your enemies. You need to be unified. Come together. Don't start throwing stones at one another because of what you are all experiencing together. In seeing the same idea, another theologian, Scott McKnight, writes this. He says, one must imagine that the oppressive conditions led to the temptation not only to violence, but also to turning against each other. Oppression leads to consternation and the yearning desire to find a way out. And James knows this, so he counsels this community not to let their anger turn to grumbling. Not to let it turn to wrathful violence, yearning to climb over one another. And so James warns them, look, your grumbling about one another is complaining. And complaining about others often comes from an aspect of judgment. And maybe you didn't hear what I just said in the last few verses, but the ultimate judge, the one who is coming, is standing right outside the door. And he hears you. He sees you. He knows you. So be careful who you judge, lest you in turn be judged yourselves. So James is telling them, watch out, because before you know it, your grumbling will only lead to your judgment. But then we get to verse 10, and James does something kind of odd. He's looking to encourage his audience. He's looking to bolster their countenance, to give them some strength through some examples of others who have gone through similar experiences. And he writes this. He says in verse 10, "As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast." And this all sounds well and good. Oh yeah, that's right. The prophets who came before us, they too were oppressed, and the Lord cared for them. But then James writes this. "You have heard of the steadfastness of Job." And I get the feeling that as soon as James says the name Job, like everybody in the room, their head just like drops. It's like, oh no, not Job. We know what he went through. We know. And James writes, "You have seen the purpose of the Lord and how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." So just we're on this, just so that you and I are on the same page here, James is using the book of Job as encouragement. Did you hear me? James is using the book of Job as encouragement. It's not a very encouraging book, at least the majority of it. I mean, Job starts off and God is sitting in heaven and his heavenly beings come around him. And it's kind of funny, the text says that Satan just kind of sneaks in with them. Just kind of like sneaks up on God. And God legitimately asks the question, "Whoa, what are you doing here?" As if God didn't know. And so he asks Satan, "What have you been doing recently?" is basically how it comes out. And Satan says, "Oh, you know, I was just kind of wandering the earth, going to and fro, just kind of checking things out." And then God, almost like showing off a little bit, and poor Job, Satan doesn't even bring Job up. It's God who brings Job up. God says, "You know, have you seen my buddy Job down there? He's pretty impressive. He's pretty awesome. He praises me." And Satan goes, "Well, yeah, but I mean, you've blessed him in so many ways. How could he not praise you?" And it's almost like God sees that as a challenge. He's like, "Okay, game on. Do what you want with Job. Just don't touch him." So Satan's like, "Okay, let's do this." And so he goes down and he afflicts Job unbelievably so. All in a span of the same day, the same moments, Job has servants run up to him that say, "Job, you just lost all of the animals that you own. Some were killed, some were taken off by thieves, but they're all gone. Oh, by the way, all of the servants, except for the ones who escaped to come tell Job, they're all dead. They're all gone. Oh, and by the way, all of your children, as in all of them, as in every single one, were having a feast in a house, and it just so happened that that house collapsed, and they're all dead." Like, it's so horrible that you can almost laugh at the misery. Please don't, that'd be awkward. But I get you, I think you know what I mean. It's incredible. Job loses everything. And of course, Job is distraught, and he comes to God, and he doesn't know why this is happening, but he does not curse God. He does not blame God. And so it happens again that the heavenly beings are surrounding God in heaven, and Satan kind of makes his way in again. And God says, "So, hey, have you seen my awesome guy, Job? He's still praising me." And so Satan again says, "Well, yeah, because you didn't let me touch him. You didn't let me mess with his health. Let me do that, and I guarantee he'll be cursing you." So God goes, "Okay, go for it." And so once again, Satan comes to Job, and he just covers him in these sores, head to toe, sores everywhere. And as Job is sitting there scraping off these sores with a piece of pottery, his wife comes up to him and says, "You know what, why don't you just curse God and die?" I think that might have been part of Satan's plot too, but I won't go into that. Job doesn't do it. He does not curse God. He does not blame God. But here's what's interesting. Even in this example of Job and his steadfastness through these trials and tribulations, Job is not silent. Job doesn't just sit there and say, Lord, thank you for this, that I might learn more and be drawn closer to you through it. I am blessed from this suffering. That's not Job's response. Job cries out to God. Job says, I don't understand. I don't get why this is happening. I'm not blaming you, and I'm not cursing you for this, but I don't get it. I don't get it. And I think James uses the story of Job for a purpose. Job is patient through all of his trials and tribulations. He is patient, and he ultimately is faithful to God, but he was not passive. He was not a pacifist. He cried out to God and said, I don't get this. I don't understand. Please, where are you? I need you. I need your deliverance. Where is it? Where is it? And so there is this idea that James is not saying patience is waiting on the Lord in complete and total silence with never a complaint or a question to God. But patience does call for a lack of violence against those who are oppressing you, for only God is judge. And so James is calling for this middle ground of refraining from lashing out physically in violence, but at the same time pursuing justice through wise speech. But in everything, being patient and waiting on the Lord. Which brings us full circle. It brings us full circle. Because waiting is something that we simply don't do well. Our culture, the world we see around us, constantly demands that we have everything instantly. There is no more need for patience. And the less we are called to use it, the more it escapes us. But here's the thing. Many of the realities of our lives, everything in our life that isn't a material object that we can possess, there's no fast-forwarding through those. Hurt, grief, loss, pain, tragedy. There's no instant gratification for those. The only remedy for those is patience in the Lord. Is dwelling in Him. And allowing Him to dwell in us and waiting on Him. Those things cannot be solved overnight. And so we are left with only one option. Be patient. Wait on the Lord. He has not abandoned us. He has loved us at our most unlovable. And His love carries us. It sustains us. And so as we read these verses here today, I want you to walk away with this. I don't know what you're going through. Even right now, it's not a mistake that you are here. I don't know what you are experiencing. What hardships, what trials, what hurts, what pain is a reality of your life in this moment. As we sit here, that distract your thoughts even now, the things you can't escape. I don't know what those are. But God does. Your God, the God of the universe, He sees you, He knows you, He loves you, and He is working for your good. He has not abandoned you. Rather, He has given you His Spirit, That very Spirit which raised Christ from the dead lives within you, dwells within you to strengthen you, encourage you, and sustain you. So be patient and wait on the Lord, knowing that whether it's in this life or when we are in heaven, only Christ can give us rest.